This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. It's the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and we're back from summer break with a look at a bunch of brand new watches. But before we get to the Leias from Geneva, Cupertino, and beyond, just a quick note that for the fall schedule, Hodinkee Radio will be moving to an every other week format. But don't worry, you'll still get at least two episodes a month, and I'll do my best to make them great. Case in point, for this episode, we're chatting about the latest watches announced at or around Geneva Watch Days, and some of the latest updates to the Apple Watch. To help me keep the show on track, I'm joined by Logan and Danny, so let's talk about some watches. All right, Logan, Danny, it's been a little while. Glad to have the show back up and running, and a pleasure to see both of you guys digitally. Where, Logan, you've been moving around quite a bit, right? Where are you based?
Yes, sir. Yeah. It's good to see you guys. I am back in New York as of last night. I was in Geneva for about 7-8 days, then in New York for 48 hours. Then I flew out to Cupertino to check out the latest and greatest from Apple. Yeah, back in New York, and I should be here about 10 days, I think.
Okay, that's not bad.
But lovely to
maintaining
see
maintaining your residency.
You guys. Yeah. Lovely to see you guys, albeit virtually.
And Danny, how are we doing on your end?
Oh, doing well. You know, same old, living the dream, writing a lot. Yeah, I mean,
it's been an exciting couple of weeks for new product and stuff to write about and that sort of thing. And I want to dig right into it. And the nice thing is we've got the man from the source right here with Logan. Logan, you want to kick us off with a little chat about Geneva Watch Days? Because you're out there and covered the whole thing. And we really would have not had anywhere near as a robust sort of look at the show if you hadn't been able to get out there. So I thought it turned out really well.
Thanks, James. Yeah, it's an interesting show. It's the first time that Hodinkee has sent someone out to the show, which kind of started in the middle of the pandemic in 2020 as a result of the kind of traditional watch shows shutting down. SIHH in Basel. SIHH now is of course Watches and Wonders, which we did all attend this year. But Geneva Watch Days was started by Breitling, Bulgari, MB&F, Erwerk, maybe half a dozen other brands as a way to kind of welcome. In 2020, it was all Euro-based journalists and media and press and retailers. And last year, there was a few people from North America and Asia that came in. And this year, you know, we actually saw kind of a broad base of global international media flock to Geneva to attend. And it is quite different than the old shows that we're used to, and even Watches and Wonders, which follows along that same kind of, you know, within a trade show hall, you're running in between appointments, big booths set up. Geneva Watch Days is set up in all the really, really fancy, bougie hotels that are based right along Lake Geneva. So you have the Beau Rivage, you have the Four Seasons, you have the Ritz-Carlton, you have three or four others, and all the brands just set up in these, you know, very nice hotel suites that are, they're a little old-fashioned in some capacity. You know, they're not like the high-tech New York, LA, San Francisco hotels that you see when you travel to those big American cities. They're still very kind of, they feel almost aristocratic in some capacity, very very rococo, I guess I would say.
Yeah, that's definitely my impression of the Beau Rivage. You're walking into marble, basically. It's a very beautiful, gorgeous cave somehow, you know, rendered on the shore of Lake Geneva.
Absolutely. No, that's a wonderful visual description. The Beau Rivage really is the center of the action. There's probably about 20 brands that were set up on, you know, the 6 or 7 floors there. So instead of running in between, you know, huge booths at the Plexpo, which is the big fair grounds in Geneva, or the Messeplatz in Basel, you're literally running around on the shore of Lake Geneva to go in between these different hotels. And it's a bit more relaxed, but you know, you still want to meet with as many brands as possible. So, you know, I was taking 8 to 10 meetings per day, you know, each one 30 minutes or an hour, and just having to sprint in between, again, on the shore of Lake Geneva, you know, from one side or to the other. If brands had boutiques, you know, they would host meetings there. But it was a cool experience. It's a less corporate show, I would say.
That's cool. And what I thought was interesting was, you never really know what you're going to get from the Geneva shows. I mean, we're getting a broader range of product these days from Watches and Wonders because Baselworld isn't a presence anymore. But with these ones, you know, for a long time, SHH was the fancy stuff. You know, it was a lot of luxury brands. It was a lot of the higher end stuff. And if you're a sport watch guy, if you're a dive watch nerd, like that sort of thing, like you kind of felt like, well, these are amazing things, but it's more hypothetical product than it is something that I can get really jazzed about. We got a handful of pretty interesting watches, kind of in a big spectrum. Logan, I'd love to start. Like, what can you not really get out of your mind since you got back from Geneva? What stands out to you?
I will say that it did feel a lot like the SIHH of yore in the fact that it was a lot of very expensive, you know, luxury brands, you know, talking about six-figure watches. But instead of it being, you know, heavy on the Richemont side of things, it was, you know, a lot of independence. So yeah, MB&F, yeah. Erwerk, Moser. One of my favorite watches that I saw was from the independent Crayon. I hope mm-hmm. I said that right. It isn't Crown, so there's no Crayola action here. but they have this just really brilliant sunrise-sunset complication. And it's been out for about 2 years, but this is the first time I had the chance to see it in person. And it's just so simple. You know, it's like the equation of time complication in some respects, in that you do have to have it mechanically set to the area where you want the sunrise-sunset complication. But the nice thing is that once it's set, you don't have to mess with it at all. You can change it backward or forward. You know, you can go back in time without an issue. And it's under 10 millimeter, and it's just, you know, the finish is brilliant. The dial is extremely attractive. That was one of my favorites. I thought it was great to see the split escapement from MB&F.
Oh, yeah, that must have been fun to see in person.
Yeah, yeah, and they've had such a strong year with the first chronograph, which came out back in June. Just a great to catch up with those guys. Yeah, and then on the kind of other end of the spectrum, Moser with the Vanta Black dial and the red gold. You know, I've said this on the record before, but Moser was a company that I've always appreciated and enjoyed, but I've never really had a release from them that just kind of blew me away and was like, okay, this is a grail. But this year they've had two of those with the cylindrical tourbillon that came out at Watches and Wonders, which I just found to be one of the most kind of captivating exercises in tourbillon watchmaking, particularly just from the visual standpoint. You know, from the technical side, Grubel always does really interesting stuff, but just visually, that spherical tourbillon I just found captivating. That was at Watches and Wonders, and then the new Streamliner, which was in red gold and Vanta Black dial, was just, but with those two releases, all of a sudden Moser just, they haven't been able to miss this year. It's just incredible. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there were also in the Beau Rivage, Oris and Doxa were presenting, and they both had two of the strongest releases, I would say, with the Diver 65 12-hour bezel caliber 400 and the stainless steel edition of the Army, which I think, you know, are just both very enthusiast-friendly, a solid price point, you know, just really attractive watches at the end of the day. Yeah, but what did you guys think from the shores of, you know, the Atlantic?
Well, I definitely had some spillover. I mean, I got to go hands-on with that Moser because my wife ended up shooting it for the site for a piece that Nora Taylor wrote, and I have to agree that watch is, like, insane. Just the combination of an entirely rose gold Streamliner bracelet paired with just Vanta Black and then the tourbillon just kind of appearing as if it's just on nothing is really wild to see in person. And you really forget how heavy a watch like that can be in the best way possible. So that was something that stood out. But then I think the Oris was one of my favorites because Oris has done a great job over the years with the Diver 65 line, creating sort of these homage to mid-century diver style watchmaking, you know, even before Tudor was in that game in a way. And I think that this watch feels the most modern while also like utilizing that same kind of design ethos. And, you know, reading your piece on it, Logan, your introducing piece before I had a chance to go hands-on with that watch too, it just like reminded me how useful that bezel can be. You know, I'm not typically going diving. I would use a dive time bezel probably more than I would a chronograph, but a 12-hour bezel in terms of, you know, it's to utilize it for travel and just to monitor a second time zone is actually super functional. And I spent like, I would say 4 or 5 days with the watch. And, you know, it kind of, its simplicity kind of blew me away. I know it's sort of the pick that a lot of people are going to go after this year because it's really just a smart looking piece, but I really enjoyed that one.
I think there's something to be said for passive complications that, you know, like a 12-hour bezel where you can kind of set it and live with it rather than something that requires your kind of immediate attention, you know, such as a chronograph. Not that, you know, you can't just set a chronograph and let it go.
Just let it run.
Yeah, you can just let it run. But I don't know. I think there's something to be said with being able to just kind of consistently and constantly engage with some aspect of our watches that make them different, whether it's a GMT hand or a 12-hour bezel or a dive bezel. I really like that kind of, that's my vibe for the rest of the year, passive complications.
Yeah, I love the 12-hour bezel. I think they're super clever, they're easy to use, and they're not commonly around. And when you have so many versions of a dive watch, especially a 100-meter dive watch that isn't especially toolish as much as it is a little bit more like an old-school throwback, like a style play, I think those are solid watches. The Diver 65, I have the first of the Hodinkee LEs and really enjoy it. But that 12-hour bezel not only really suits the watch in general, like aesthetically, but they've done a nice job making it kind of balance out and work. And the sort of monochromatic appeal of that watch, especially now that we've seen the Diver 65 in so many colors, in different metals and mixed metals and things like that, this feels kind of elemental. And then add in that movement at that price point, and I think they've got an absolute winner. I hope it's the kind of thing that just kind of quietly stays on there, on the kind of layout for that model for a while, because I think that, you know, I watch brands almost like a lot of brands that sell a product in a store via third parties like ADs and distributors and such are probably fearful of anything that requires an explanation. And like a 12-hour bezel does require a slight explanation, a little bit more than the internal logic of, say, a countdown or a count-up bezel. And I could see that being something that could have an effect on how people see the watch, like if they don't understand what the bezel does. We'll put an explainer if you don't know what a 12-hour bezel does and how easy they are to use. I'll put it in the show notes, of course. But it is a clever thing where it's a complication that has no cost. The only thing you lose for a 12-hour bezel is you now don't have a dive bezel. And on that watch, I think it works out to make just a really simple, clever, everyday sports watch. And I think they did it. And that's kind of what the brand excels at. So it's not surprising in any metric. You know, the other ones that stood out for me, obviously, I wrote a ton about it. The Pelagos 39 is a huge release. Logan, you got to see it kind of first. I saw it a few hours later here in Toronto. Danny, you saw it in New York not too long ago.
I did. I saw it two nights ago in New York.
So my first question, and this is just for fun, is because I think a lot of watches don't necessarily look like they're render when normal actual environmental light hits them. Like a normal Pelagos, the standard 42 mil Pelagos, looks almost identical to its render because there's no shiny to any part of it. But the new one in lower light is very, I mentioned this in my hands-on, it's what I mostly want to convey, is like the watch can definitely be judged by its specs and by the movement and by Tudor's build quality and the rest of it, but you might want to see it in person, especially for the way that the light interacts with the bezel. What did you guys think?
I really, really, really like it. You know, I've always thought the Pelagos was just such an attractive, modern, contemporary design, and that's something that is fairly rare in the contemporary watchmaking scene to have a just truly contemporary design. Yes, there's some kind of hints of Submariner in it, but everything has a hint of Submariner in it these days. It's like Genghis Khan of dive watches, right? I liked the sunburst finish on the bezel. I think that'll be a hit or miss thing for some people, but I don't know. I just had no, like, I wish they did this, I wish they did that. I personally really like the snowflake hour hand. I've always enjoyed that.
You know, bezel still feels great. It's really thin. It sits really low and really tight on your wrist. I don't even like bracelets, but that bracelet would change my mind. Do I miss the clasp? Absolutely. T-Fit still rocks. And you still have the wetsuit extension if that's something, if you lead a lifestyle in which you need that. And I implore all of you to try to have a use for a wetsuit extension every now and then. But yeah, I think it's just solid, really conventional, mass market sports watch product. Like, it's what Tudor does really well. They've taken kind of what has worked from evolving the BB and what has worked from part of the Pelagos and kind of made, like, in my mind, like a nine, like a modern Snowflake.
Yeah, I think it's also like just deceptively, like the lightness of it. Because when you pick up a Pelagos, whatever, at 42 millimeters, the other versions of it, how light it is with the titanium throws you off because it's a thick, chunky watch. But this one being way more proportional and more what we're used to from sort of conventional dive watch sizing, it's even lighter. I mean, it even feels lighter to me in that regard. What I think about it in terms of my first impressions of it is it doesn't necessarily do for me what it's doing for both of you. However, I think that's its strength because I do have this sort of feeling that when a watch knocks your socks off in terms of, let's say, like, you know, colors or, you know, a new funky design, I feel like everything here was pared back, you know, kind of simplified, made a little bit more conservative in a way that I think will make this watch last longer. And when the newness wears off, I think my opinion of this watch will change. I think this is the sort of watch that you could buy and own and wear and just have this be sort of your core piece in your collection. I think the markers, which if I'm not mistaken, I think the BB Pro was the first one to do this. Those ceramic luminous markers have this like crazy depth to them. And they remind me so much of like a modern version of just painted markers of old. Like before we had these surrounds on the dial, which made watches feel a bit more luxurious. And I think a lot of people yearn for the vintage stuff because it's missing that charm. And Tudor is captured in the Pelagos specifically that charm, but in a modern context. Because nothing about the Pelagos, aside from, I guess, the LHD in a way, has felt sort of vintage inspired. And this one has that, you know, the red text or whatever, but on the whole, it's a very modern piece. And bezel notwithstanding, I think the bezel is something that I need to get used to. I'll say this right now. I mean, when I saw it in New York the other night, I actually, at first glance, I thought the person who I saw it on was wearing a Seiko, just because it does remind me a bit about how the Seiko bezels kind of burst and shine a little bit, like the SPB 143, which I think is the watch you have, right, James?
Yep.
And then I looked at it and I was like, oh, whoa. So it will take some time for me to get used to that. But no, I think it's a really interesting release. And I think a year ago, none of us would have thought the Pelagos was going to have a moment like this, where we thought Tudor was just going full on into Black Bay mode and the Pelagos was kind of left behind. And it's kind of interesting to see that it's become a focal point.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is a different direction. And that's what I tried to say, is like, it definitely feels like a Pelagos, but in some ways it almost feels more Tudor-y. Like Pelagos almost felt like its own thing. Like it could have been its own brand in some ways, right? Like it was just such a move when it came out. And I think this kind of makes enough concessions to become more wearable. But of course, you do give up some of the like flagship elements of the Pelagos. If you're keen on getting into this or more of this discussion, there's about 900 comments between the two stories. So feel free to get in there. I feel like we've talked plenty about the Pelagos. The other two that I don't want to sleep on, the first is that Doxa Army now in steel for a hair over $2,000. That's a killer watch. It was great in ceramic. I really like the aesthetic of that watch, but at $2,000 on the rubber, I think it's 2050. I don't really care for the bimetal one, the one with the bronze bezel and the green. I don't mind. The green is fine. The green ceramic insert's fine. But the stock, the cheapest one that you can get, and then put it on a different strap is what I would do. I just absolutely love it. I mean, that on a mesh, steel mesh bracelet would look so rad.
Yeah, it's just a attractive, cool watch that doesn't really have a competitor on the market.
Yeah, it's probably other, you know, other Doxas, the sub 300 T's, 1890.
Yeah.
And the cheapest you can get a 300, which is their best wearing watch by my measure, is about $2,500, $2,450. I believe the Army is a little bit thicker. But the other weird thing is like Doxas don't wear like other watches because they have little dials and kind of wide cases, but they sit really low. The nice thing is they, you know, now they have some retail environments in the States, so you could actually go see a brand that it used to just be pictures. I was pretty pumped to see that one. I think that's just kind of like the Oris, just good product, and that it's not limited. It'll just be in their lineup. It's attractive. And I think it gives a slightly different aesthetic to the Doxa world that you don't get from the, you know, the litany of the sub range.
Okay, it's time for our ad break. And anyone who has ever bought themselves a nice watch and then tried to add it to an insurance policy will know just how big a hassle it can be to get your watch insured. You need receipts, an appraisal, a pile of photos, and lots of patience just to get your watch properly protected. Frankly, it sucks, so we decided to make something better. Hodinkee Insurance is the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance.
And then the other one, and this is a real left turn for me in terms of what we've been talking about, the Oris, the Pelagos, and the new Doxa, is Logan, did you get a chance to see this Grubel 4Z GMT in person?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I actually...
Goodness sakes, it's cool.
I mean, James, you are like me in that everything Grubel does is just remarkable.
Best.
It's incredible. I remember we published a story a while back, and I forget who the author was, but it was something along the lines of, this is the only $800,000 watch where it feels like you're getting $800,000 worth of, you know, you're getting your money's worth there. And it's hard to imagine that until you actually kind of spend 30 minutes just going over a Grubel with a loop, and yeah, and you see the amount of detail and the degree of execution. I mean, there is really no competitor for Grubel 4C on the market. Like, a Grubel 4C's competitor is, you know, it's a boat or a second house or something along those lines.
Sure.
There's no watch that is the competitor to a Grubel 4C.
Yeah, I think if what you want is a Grubel 4C, you're kind of like, this is what, there's not like three or four brands doing what they do. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just them. And the level of finishing is ridiculous. I will forever love the Sig 1.
Mm, yes, yeah.
Like, no watch looks better under magnification. No watch is a better reason to have a macro lens or a great loop or, you know, whatever option you have. And you know, look, Grubel is one of these brands, especially, I think I could say this for all three of us, but certainly for me, I have to completely ignore what they cost.
Oh, yeah. The price is secondary.
This is a $400,000 watch, and I said it's expensive in the same way that the sun is hot. and I think, it's so cool that somebody's making this.
Yeah.
I am surprised that they can charge $400,000 and someone buys it, but I would say it's right. More of a delightful sort of surprise than a shocking sort of surprise. You know, the fact that there's a micro economy of, one, people who are willing to make these, and two, people who are willing to buy them, is delightful. It you know, this is a essentially a mix of a GMT and a world timer. It does a lot of different things. And it's in this convex case style, which is kind of a rift that's going through several of their models. Mm-hmm. They're only making a few a year for only a few years. It's big. It, you know, it has this huge, crazy view of the dial because of the shape of the case and the way the crystal moves, and the fact that they've mirror polished the entire edge of the case, the internal edge, where a Riot would be on a more conventional watch. The level of finishing is so high that you can just kind of get lost in the photos they provide. It's there's so much fun to see in person. It's really hard to explain a brand like Grubel to someone who's not had the chance to see one in the metal. So I don't even know how you would do it necessarily, but if you happen to live somewhere where you can see it, or you're going on a vacation somewhere, that call ahead, see if they'll you know, put the gloves on and bring one out for 20 minutes or whatever, because that experience is kind of singular within watches.
The company, I actually had a chance to visit the Grubel manufacturer on Friday after Geneva Watch Day wrapped up.
Cool building too.
It's my second time there, and it's just the most remarkable architecture in the watch industry for any manufacturer I've been to. It's this 17th or 18th century farmhouse. That's how you walk in. And then attached to the farmhouse is this just insane wall of glass that extends outward. And it has one of those living roofs, so there's sheep that will graze on top of the roof where all the watchmakers are working. And Stephen 4C and Robert Grubel are taking a step back to a certain degree because they've spent the past 20 years building the brand to a remarkable degree. And they're taking a step back and letting kind of the next generation of leaders kind of guide the company's a future. You know, it's not going to be one of those brands where it is based on the founders. You know, Grubel is 4C is strong because of the brand Grubel 4C, not just because of Robert Grubel and Stephen 4C, as brilliant and charming as they are. You know, they're trying to build the brand up for the next 50 years. And part of that is, you know, redefining how the watches look on the and feel on the wrist. And that's why we're seeing that convex case design kind of go through all the different collections. They're streamlining different lineups. They're trying to hit new production goals. 200 watches is a big deal. By 2026, I think they want to hit 500 watches. I can't even imagine 500 Grubel 4Cs being produced in a single year without any compromises to the finish, to the decoration.
It's a big task.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a big thing. You know, they're trying to offer things at an entry level price point. And the reason I laugh when I say entry level is because, you know, that's 150,000. It's not 1500.
Yeah, I think a Sig one was 170, 177, something like that when it came out. And it was among their most reasonably priced offerings. It's a fascinating brand. I would love to be able to see one of these convex models in person. So got to add that to the list for the next time I make a little trip through Europe. But I would love to see the studio as well. That's super fun. And as far as Geneva Watch Days, anything else stand out? Danny, there was some pretty solid AP stuff, right? They went full blue.
They did go full blue, and they also went blue and tourbillon as well. So there's a lot of blue in the AP lineup this year that Logan covered, and I got to see some of them here in New York. You know, it's funny how Geneva Watch Days is a thing unto itself, but some brands on the periphery kind of latched on to the moment, which I wanted to which is great, which is cool, because I think in today's watch world, everything's kind of decentralized in a way, and we come to expect it. But the AP stuff, for me, AP doing their ceramic is just, it's always fun to see. I don't know that it like blows my mind or is like super impressive or, I mean, of course it's impressive, but it's just cool to see a blue ceramic AP QP in the hand. It wears a little funny, just in the way that the ceramic case and the ceramic bracelet kind of work together. It's very blocky is the best way to put it. Like, I don't know if my wrist can kind of like handle that watch in a way. But my God, if it's not cool, if it's not just like a cool object. The white QP ceramic is one of my favorite things that AP has done in recent memory. And the blue just strikes me as just a fun take on that idea. I don't know what you think of it, Logan. I mean, it really did kind of take us all by surprise when it launched, and it was something that it seems like in the comment section on the site people were pretty into it too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a hot watch, man. Like, people complain about kind of the monopoly of attention that the Royal Oak has just on, I don't know, general watch enthusiasm, but it deserves all of it and more in my opinion. Like, there's not a more attractive, badass, interesting watch out there in so many ways. Like, I whenever I get the opportunity to handle, you know, a 15-202, I still haven't seen a 16-202.
Hope
to remedy that soon. But anytime I get the chance to see a jumbo or any variation of the kind of traditional Royal Oak, I just, you know, you feel like you're handling something different than, I don't know, a run-of-the-mill dive watch or the solidly, you know, four figure watches that make up my personal watch collection. Like, it's the finish is different, the way it sits on your wrist is different. It's just
the real treat is if you have a friend whose wrist is the same size as yours. So you actually get to try one unsized.
Yes.
Because
yes,
the non-sized Royal Oak experience is like, meh, what's going on here? It feels like there's about 30 too many links in a full-sized one. I was hanging out in LA years ago for this UTA pop-up thing we did, and the shop had an early solid gold in 39 with the gray dial, and it fit me. And I wore it around for a couple days, and it's just like, I feel like that is one of those watches where you have an opinion before you get a chance to try one on.
Yeah,
that's been sized. And then there's a moment after that where you go like, dang it, this is just a lot of fun.
That's the key. The size is the key. I've had that experience. It blows my mind. And like, when I trade with the friend who lets me try it on, I like really don't want to give it back. You know, I just want to just casually walk out of wherever we are and just keep that on my wrist. I mean, it's crazy.
For me, it's all, I really like the QPs in precious metals. real sucker for the early generations, the four digits and the really early five digit QPs that didn't even have the leap year indicator. Those are a blast in my mind. And I mean, I wrote a story at this point almost a couple years ago, and like looking back and finding like Sotheby's results from within the 2000s where they were selling for 11 grand. Somebody got away with a whole lot of watch on that one. But yeah, so Geneva Watch Days, I think, was pretty successful. We had some core sport watch, like good product, and lots of exciting, like crazy expensive stuff at the same time. But I also don't want to skip out on what happened on, you know, more of a North American front. Logan, you got to see, I have to admit, I'm not an Apple Watch user. I've set one up a couple times for family members. If I read everything and I watched the video where they announced it and the rest, the new series for the core is kind of a nice evolution, but in the same format that we've had for a little while. And now we also have the Ultra. Where would you start with these updates? Because you were in the room, you got to see them in person.
Yeah. I got to go out to Apple Park for the first time and check out the whole, I don't know, Apple land that they have out there, which is a really interesting and unique experience. Very different than kind of the New York atmosphere that I'm used to. And the Ultra is just, I mean, it's a remarkable piece of kit at the end of the day. You know, it's certified as a dive computer. Like, you can just jump in the water with your wetsuit and everything, and you're good to go. A new band that they have that they designed for diving is really interesting. It has this spring-loaded extension made out of titanium that is just a really clever. I mean, like you said, James, everything is very thoughtfully done. What I find interesting about Apple Watch as a whole is actually very similar to what I find interesting about watches and watchmaking. There's a lot of point of entries. You can come to an Apple Watch or general watchmaking through so many different angles, you know, and you can get a Apple Watch because you want to be able to exercise, because you want your notifications on hand. You want it as an extension of your iPhone. For watches, you can come through them, you know, through aesthetics, through engineering, through history. But then once you're kind of solidly in there, once you've owned an Apple Watch, once you wear it, you find all these little rabbit holes. And you can go down those rabbit holes. They're endless to a certain degree. And the Ultra just kind of extends that, you know. And what I like about watches is that, yeah, I can spend a whole week learning about Royal Oak perpetual calendars. I can go back and read James's story, which is one of my favorite Hodinkee stories ever. You better link to that in the show notes, and just learn everything. And then with an Apple Watch, you know, if I own one, I can kind of just go down like I can become a health nut based entirely on the Apple Watch. I can learn all these new things about myself from wearing it. I can, and you know, I can spend all for 3 months, I can just be focused on the health aspects. I don't know, there's just so many different areas to explore and learn that I think anyone that hasn't strapped one on for a week or so to just try it out, you know, is missing out, because it's an incredible piece of kit, and the Ultra just kind of extends that.
What I find interesting is it's a market move that I don't normally attribute to Apple, where they are the most dominant smartwatch by any number when it comes to the core, you know, series of the Apple Watch, which is, you know, kind of sits really nicely at $400 to $500. And then you can kind of go in a few different directions, and there's a lower end model, and they still generally, they've been offering past generations as well for lower price points. The interesting thing about the Ultra for me is, one, it's obviously a swipe at Suunto and Garmin and these folks that have like a multi-sport tool watch. It's not like an overpopulated field, the like premium multi-sport watch, but it is interesting to see them go this direction and also lead in terms of price. Typically, when Apple makes a higher end product, they also run the highest price point. And Logan, the Ultra is only available in one spec, 49 millimeters in titanium, and it's $800. Is that accurate?
Yeah, which I expected. You know, there was some leaks and rumors before the show that said they were going to release a titanium 49 millimeter. You know, I think the rumor was the Apple Watch Pro. I'm glad they went with Ultra name instead of the Pro name. But the pricing I saw was around 1,000. So when $800 flashed across the screen in Steve Jobs Theater, I was pretty surprised. I mean, because again, you're getting a whole lot of product there for your money.
Yeah, I mean, the size is something that I want to get to, definitely. But like, even just a comparison, like if you want a multi-sport watch that also functions as a dive computer. And I'll be fair, I haven't done like an if I get to eventually try out the Ultra, I would have a better idea of how it compares to something like a Garmin Descent, which I've used, I've dove with, I've run, I've hiked, I've really put that watch through its uses, and it really does offer a comparable sort of feature set, what appears to be a comparable battery life, which is a major concern for these ones, especially if you talk to people doing long-term, long endurance activities. But adding in the dive computer really changes the number, because at $800, I think the Descent Mark II, I guess the 43 mil, which is what I have, which doesn't have air integration, is $1,000. And then the Apple doesn't offer air integration, which is literally a little radio, transmitter that goes on a high pressure line from your scuba tank. And it could tell you how much air you have left on your wrist rather than using a separate gauge. It's kind of a flashy feature if you dive a lot. It's an interesting way that they've come at it, because I don't know that they necessarily all do exactly the same thing between a high-end Sonto, a high-end Garmin, and the Ultra, but it does a lot of the same things that people are going to expect from it. Like, I like the Garmin stuff a lot, but I'm really reticent to get into the 46 to 52 millimeter range. I have a Fenix 6S, which is 42 millimeters, and I have a Descent Mark IIs, which is 43. And they wear nicely. They don't weigh that much because they're a resin, a plastic case of some sort. How did you find the 49 millimeters? And allow me a possibly silly question. Which is 49 essentially the lug to lug is what they're measuring there?
I believe it's the lug to lug. I'll have to break out my calipers and check.
49 lug to lug is not huge for a big sport watch.
Not for a square watch at the end of the day. I mean, we all know that square watches wear differently than round watches. They generally wear a bit more compact. And yeah, when I tried on the 49 millimeter, I mean, it felt at the edge of what I would feel comfortable wearing. But yes, I would feel comfortable wearing it. And, you know, I'm not going to strap on a 49 millimeter 2004 Invicta anytime soon, which would be, you know, 49 millimeters or whatever. But I would feel comfortable strapping the Apple Watch Ultra on any day of the week. It felt good on the wrist, and it has that little flank, which in my story I called out as kind of reminiscent. It reminded me of the Nautilus in a bit, which Joni Ive, the former Apple design chief officer, is famous for wearing around.
And so just so that we get this clear, because I had to dig around to find this information, and I found it kind of cool. If you want to compare the Apple Watch to another watch, one, like Logan said, remember it's square, so it's not going to wear the same. But it's 44 millimeters wide, 49 essentially lug to lug, and 14.4 thick. So it's the size of a lot of modern dive watches. Could you see somebody picking this as the watch that they actually wear, say, 6 or 7 days a week, not only when they're diving or hiking or doing an ultra marathon or whatever, but also as their Apple Watch for their notifications and to tell the time and that kind of thing?
Absolutely, I think. You know, I mean, you're going to want to be able to take advantage of those features if you're going to go for the Apple Watch Ultra. But I don't think there's nothing about it that would say like, oh, I need to have an Apple Watch Ultra for exercising and a normal Apple Watch Series 8 for my day-to-day life. Like, I would just, if I was going to be out there diving, hiking, etc., I would use the Ultra as my everything.
What do you think of these, Danny? You got any taste for an Apple Watch? Have you worn one a bit?
I've worn some of the early ones. I will say I'm intrigued by the design change. You know, I think it's kind of hilarious that an Apple Watch now has crown guards. just by the very nature of that, I was talking to some watch friends of mine, and one of them like just purchased one on that alone. Just thought that was so like kind of off the Apple path that they were like, you know what, I'm gonna pick one up, because it does kind of. I feel like what Apple's doing is kind of playing to two types of buyers now. There was a funny thing I saw online where someone was asking what is Apple's sort of core audience at this point, because it strikes them that it could be the post-pandemic crowd that's no longer in the office but kind of getting out there and hiking and the outdoors, but they're just really bad at it, so they need all these extra functions to save them, which I found pretty hilarious. But at the same time, It's the kind of product that scares me, because I know that if I do own one, I'll probably become sort of addicted to what it can do.
They are a weirdly sticky, like any smartwatch. I haven't spent much time with an Apple Watch, but like I rambled on about earlier, I've had a bunch of experience with Garmin stuff, And like once you set them up on your phone and you kind of get an understanding of how much it's going to bother you and what messages will come and what won't, and then it starts doing the sleep tracking and all these other metrics, like it becomes this kind of weird little ecosystem that you step into, and then leaving it for a conventional watch, one that ticks and you have to wind it and the rest of it, can sometimes feel like you're giving up a lot of functionality that I wouldn't normally attribute to a watch. And I think that's why one of the reasons this product has become kind of dominant and important as an iPhone accessory is because they're just weirdly sticky. Like there's lots of times when you can't have your phone with you or you're asleep or whatever, but these things kind of do provide a 24-hour functionality that I can't say I'm necessarily sold on, but the Ultra has me interested. If they hadn't released the Ultra, I'm not sure I would have bothered talking about Apple Watch on the pod today, like Logan went. So of course we could do a little rundown. But for me, and I'm wondering if it's similar for you guys, you know, I use the Garmin's like a tool for a specific activity. I seldom just wear them for days on end. I keep one or two charged. And if I'm going hiking, if I'm going for a bike ride, if I'm going to do something that I want the metrics for, certainly for diving, then I would have that with me as a sort of tool. And I don't know how well the Ultra would work for that. Like my guess is to get the best value out of a watch like this, you probably have to wear it all the time to have it doing all the things that it does. I think when I first saw it, I was like, ah, whatever. It's, you know, they're doing a Garmin competitor. It's weirdly like interesting to me. I've had a few friends write me and say like, oh, I immediately bought one.
Yep.
I don't know. Would this one appeal to you guys more than a normal Apple Watch, assuming the Apple Watch has some appeal for you guys? When you're not doing a double wrist or something like that?
It might. I think the double wrist would be tough in terms of the sheer size of this one. It's not like it's huge by any metric, but
the Grubel 4 is the on one.
There you go.
Ultra on the other.
It makes a lot. That's a lot of complications. My life would be extremely complicated at that level. But this one, it's tempted me a little bit more. I like the design more. Like
Straps look cool too.
Straps look cool. The case design is interesting to me. I do like seeing Apple not just playing the hits every single year. I mean, it really does strike me as like, all right, you're going to go out there and tweak this a little bit. Now you have my attention.
Yeah, and big specs, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I do kind of wish they would have called the battery life power reserve. That would have made me laugh a lot. I'll put it this way. My attention is like firmly gotten at this point. And I think that it just, I still have that watch guy fear of taking my watch off.
Becoming a smartwatch
guy?
Yeah,
taking my watch off, putting it down, picking it up, putting it on, and then never taking it off again.
Yeah, no, I know exactly that concern that like you'll find this too compelling or you'll get too attached to it.
Yeah.
It's like two different mindsets. Like there's a watch nerd mindset that wants that mechanical side. But for me, I have to be honest, like I also have a side of me that just loves gadgets.
Yeah.
And new tech and like that's not going away. I still read about cameras I'll never buy. The same thing with cars, you know, like it's a fascination. And something like a normal Apple Watch doesn't trigger that fascination like this Ultra does for me. I think it's cool.
Me too.
I'd definitely like to try and get some hands-on with it at some point. And my guess is they'll be a little bit tough to buy for a little while, but that Apple's ready to make a lot of them would be my guess. Right?
Just talk to Logan.
But yeah, no, I think it could be super fun. It'll be interesting to see what it does to that market, whether it just brings a whole new wave of people who were Apple Watch wearers and thus not Garmin users, or if it really disrupts the space because of the price point, because it's kind of a different whole layout in terms of the screen and the shape and the wearability and the straps and the rest of it. But I think it's a tough market to get into because there's some specialists in there. But it's also just, it seems like they took their time with it. The Apple Watch has been around for a little while and it seems well developed. And like I said, I'm very curious.
Yeah, me too.
Well, look, guys, thanks so much for taking an hour to sit down and chit-chat about all the new watches. You know, it's just a couple times a year where we get a big wave where everybody's kind of on the same wavelength. If they want to release something, it'll come out during this run. And sure, it's a little bit of a stress and you're reading a lot of press releases. Some of them are super strange. But we get a bunch of cool new watches and a bunch to talk about. And then even some kind of disruptive elements like the Apple Watch and the new Ultra. So thanks so much for coming on, guys. It was great to chit-chat.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it.
All right. And if you're listening to the show, you know what I asked for. If you enjoyed this episode, let us know in the comments. Let us know by telling a friend and sharing the show. And otherwise, we'll chat to you in about 2 weeks' time. Thanks so much for listening.